technology now working. All right, so now we will continue the discussion of exploitation, which, as I've wanted to emphasize, should be thought of as a powerful explanatory concept of relevance to any social theory, even social theories that don't want to buy into the whole critical edge of the idea, the notion that there are certain kinds of social relationships which have this distinctive property. And above all, the way to think abstractly about this distinctive property, the part that gives it its explanatory bite, is a relationship in which the parties need each other. Their lives are bound together. They can't escape it. They're bound together, and yet one imposes harms on the other. That's a peculiar kind of relationship. It's a relationship fraught with complexity. And when you think about it, how do you maintain and reproduce a social relationship that has those two properties? Interdependence and systematic harm. It's a kind of relationship that needs a lot of work to keep in place. And that's what exploitation gives you. To give precision to the concept as a sociological idea, I've built my thinking around this contrast between simpler forms of oppression, which involve simple exclusion from access to resources, where there is the interdependence of well-being, but there isn't the interdependence of activity. Right? So that the welfare of oppressors depends upon the ill-fare of the oppressed, but their lives are not continually bound together within a social relation. Versus exploitation, when the first criterion is still present, but their lives are also bound together. And the key idea of the bounded togetherness of their lives is that the exploiter appropriates the fruits of effort. We can just say they appropriate the effort, but really what they're appropriating is what the effort is doing, what it's producing. And that's the bounded togetherness. That's why the oppressor in the exploitative relationship can't just get rid of the oppressed.
So we were actually talking about this in our core mentoring last week, this very issue. I wonder if you could talk a little about, in that sense, gender oppression you wouldn't consider exploitation.
I'll get to it in a moment. I'm going to discuss sexual exploitation, which I do think can be exploitation. With gender, it's not so obvious. It may or may not be. Some things are social relations that reinforce some other form of oppression or exploitation. But the exploitative aspect comes from the thing it reinforces, not from the thing itself. As an example, where race reinforces slavery, makes slavery easier to reproduce, makes it a more stable social relationship than it would otherwise be. We can say that race reinforces exploitation, it makes exploitation possible, it deepens the exploitation. But to say that race per se is exploitative is not a clear idea. It's not clear what the form of interdependency and appropriation of effort is that's the race part of that equation as opposed to the labor part of that equation. And the one way to think about it is, can you imagine a form of slavery in which there was no racial component? And the answer is yes, of course, we can imagine it. We can imagine a slave society where whites enslave whites, where blacks enslave blacks. I mean, that's perfectly imaginable. Indeed, it's happened in history. Would such a form of exploitation necessarily be less exploitative? No, it could be just as exploitative. Might it be less stable? Well, perhaps, because it would lack one symbolic form of reproduction. But perhaps there are functional substitutes. You know, there might be other ways of cementing that relationship. If race was not connected to some type of class relation, if it was a freestanding form of oppression, in what way would it be form of exploitation? It could certainly be a form of domination. could be a form of degradation. There could be all sorts of symbolic stigmas attached to it. But unless those played themselves out in exclusion from access to resources and in forms of interdependency that came along with exclusion from resources, would it be a form of economic exploitation? And I think my basic understanding is that it would not. Yeah.
Even when after a history of institutionalized racism that whites get ahead in terms of wealth and income and skill level, and then whenever social rights are extended to communities of color in order to enable them to get to that same level, when those are cut off, then those communities are cut off from equal access.
Right, so the race is the mechanism by which they are denied access to resources.
Yeah,
I agree with that, sure. Race can be the criterion, the social mechanism with its symbolic and ideological backing that excludes some people from access to schools, to jobs, to whatever.
Yeah, but then they could be used as, strike breakers and stuff or something. Would you say, only if they were used as strike breakers, then they're being exploited?
Well, they're not being exploited when they're marginalized. They're being oppressed. Because their labor is not being appropriated.
Right.
So if they're just being excluded, they're not being exploited. That doesn't mean that exclusion isn't such a bad deal and exploitation is worse. No, to the contrary. As Joan Robinson said, it's the one thing worse than being exploited in capitalism is not being exploited in capitalism. Yeah.
So if a group is oppressed rather than exploited, they become really periphery. They're not necessary anymore. So do you think an argument could be made that we have intentionally oppressed rather than exploited people based on racial components that they're easier to dispose of?
I'm hesitant to put too much intentionality in this kind of strong functionalist sense. So take inner city African American youth today, kind of the worst, the most devastated part of the African American population, which is, of course, one must remember a minority of African Americans. It's not the case that the African American population as a whole is excluded from the mainstream of American labor exploitation, social relations, and American society. That's simply false. There's a much higher concentration of such marginalization among African Americans than among Euro-Americans. But nevertheless, it's still a minority of that population. So we take that population and we ask the question, is it by design, by a deliberate move, that this population has been marginalized, as opposed to, is this a byproduct of a set of strategies which have been trying to maximize profits by deciding where to locate investment and where to build good schools, and it's a byproduct of those strategies in which it's too costly to do anything about. So that the intentionality part of it is the political elite does not want to solve the problem in a way that's constructive for that population because it would be too expensive. The simplest way of solving this problem is to have massive public works and public employment to provide good and well-paying jobs for people with limited skills, because there's a hell of a lot that needs to be done in the United States that doesn't require a lot of skills. There's plenty of needs that could be met by using collective resources to create jobs for the purpose of rebuilding our cities, rebuilding our infrastructure, creating a well-paying care work sector, and so on. But it would be very costly. So there is a solution to the problem, even within a capitalist society. It's just too costly for the interests of elites and their allies. But that's a different explanation from saying keeping them marginalized is in the interests of the elite. And I don't think that's correct. I think if there was a costless way of snapping your fingers and having the mass of inner city population able to be fully integrated into the labor force, and jobs could be provided without redistribution, I think the American, quote, ruling ruling class would snap their fingers. I don't think they have positive interests in the marginalization of that population. Another way of putting this, I hope all of you have read the Shmoo story. I was thinking that during the break, if I could do the... I brought my laptop so we could plug it into the TV here so I could do the my enactment of the Shmoo if people really... If there was a mass demand for such a performance, I would be happy to do it. I'm assuming that you've all read the Shmoo story by now. So here's the way to think of the Shmoo story and its ramifications. The reason why there are two explanations interior to the story about what happens when the residents of Dog Patch have the Shmoo. There's two internal analyses of it. One is offered by the residents of Dog Patch, and one is offered by the manager of PU, the capitalist. Okay, so the resident of Dog Patch turns out to be a Weberian. And the capitalist and his henchmen, they're Marxists. In their analysis of the consequences of the Shmoo, the Weberian Dog Patch resident says, once, this is in response to the introduction of the Shmoo, telling the capitalist what the Shmoo is. And he says, anybody, and I'm quoting directly from the ethnographic evidence here, anybody what's got a Shmoo doesn't have to work anymore. Okay, so the resident of Dog Patch sees the Shmoo as breaking the exchange relation between labor and capital. Anybody who has a Shmoo can withdraw from the labor force. They don't have to work anymore. The manager says to PU, great Scott PU, do you know what the Shmoo means? Nobody will have to work hard anymore. So the manager sees the problem as one of how do you get people to work hard? That is, how do you extract effort from people when they have the Shmoo as a fallback? The residents of Dog Patch see the problem as how do you get anybody to even show up to work anymore if they've got a fallback? Now, I think the manager is more accurate, actually, because the manager has a wider range of experience to draw on in understanding what the consequence of the Shmoo. It's true that if you live in Dog Patch and your standard of living is at the Dog Patch level, that is basic, minimal subsistence, if that's your culture of needs and your expectation as to what a decent standard of living is, then once you've got a Shmoo, you're never going to work anymore. Most workers, however, the Shmoo doesn't provide them everything they want because it only provides basic necessities. And most people want to consume things above basic necessities. That is, they want some discretionary income. And for that, they would have to work because they still don't own the means of production. They would still have to seek employment with the owners of the means of production. But it would be a lot harder for those employers to get them to work hard because the threat of firing loses a lot of its bite when the fallback solution is you have all your basic needs met. And therefore, there's a problem of extraction of labor effort. Essentially, what that means is that the Shmoo increases the power of the exploited to bargain over the distribution of the surplus and the production of the effort to the performance of the effort to generate the surplus. And that's the complexity that the concept of exploitation has. Now, bringing this back to the oppression issue. When North American settlers from Europe arrived and they saw Native Americans there, the reaction was to push them off the land. Now, the settlers would have been perfectly happy if in pushing them off the land, the Native Americans simply moved out, moved west, moved beyond the zone of settlement. White settlers would have been indifferent whether or not Native Americans who left the eastern seaboard and moved west of the Mississippi thrived or not. Indeed, because presumably they might have had some sense of guilt and moral, there might have been some sense of moral issues over the displacement. They would have had their consciences relieved somewhat if they knew that by displacing them off the land, the Native Americans were actually going to a better place than they would have otherwise been, right? So in a sense, if schmooze were available beyond the Mississippi and white settlers couldn't get there for some reason, but the Native Americans could, that would have been a perfectly good solution to the problem. That is, the white settlers had no positive interests in the fate of the Native Americans once they were removed from the land that the settlers wanted. So if they moved to some further distant place and did extremely well, lived good lives, that would not be something that would have negative effects on the white settlers. Now that's the property of pure oppression, really, economic oppression. You're indifferent to the fate of the people excluded, except with respect to the resource which you're controlling. Right? But if manna from heaven enables them to live well once they're excluded, that doesn't have any negative effects on your own, on the oppressor's well-being. That's not the case for exploitation. The shmoo is manna from heaven, after all, right? The shmoo is costless. It is not redistribution. That is, the capitalist, it's not a redistribution by taxing the capitalist to give shmoos to the poor. It's just exogenously given material well-being. And yet that harms the capitalist. And it does it by changing the power relation between capital and prospective labor. It affects the power relation. Affects the way their lives get bound together. And that's, again, the pivot of the concept of exploitation. So, and that's really the thing to just constantly remind yourself when you're thinking about these ideas and you want to deploy them in other contexts. What is it that affects the power relations within which interdependencies are formed, and the advantages of one depend upon the disadvantages of others? That's things which affect the interior character of those power relations are become relevant when you're talking about exploitation.
So the shoe functions a lot in the way that UBI would, and I remember you speaking about it before,
right,
and saying that they'd experimented with it in Washington, I think. Did you say that?
Well, in Seattle there was a basic income experiment in the 1970s, I believe, yeah.
And I was just wondering if there was any data on what that did to productivity, you know, because you're talking about how the shmoo basically changed those power relationships,
right,
so that people don't have to work as hard. How did...
So there have been various experiments in unconditional basic income. Unconditional basic income is the idea that you have a policy in place in which every person in the jurisdiction of the policy gets unconditionally a flow of income sufficient to live above the poverty line. It's basically a shmoo level income. Now, all basic income experiments are not quite shmoo-like because they're paid for out of taxation, and therefore they have redistributive aspects. So it's not a pure shmoo, it's a kind of quasi-shmoo. The one exception that I know of is, which I think the nature of the flows are such that one can really regard it as more like manna from heaven, more like a real shmoo. The Ford Foundation did it's an ongoing basic income experiment in some villages in Namibia. So the money that's coming to Namibia really is shmoo-like. It's from the Ford Foundation's investments in the global capitalist economy. It's not redistribution among any of the participants and in the social world in which this occurs. So they picked a couple of villages and gave everybody in the village a monthly stipend with no other services, nothing else, just to see it. It's a kind of pure basic income experiment. It's if you do basic income Namibia, you'll get online, you'll see about how this worked. Now, it turned out to have fantastic effects on poverty and all the consequences of poverty in the village, but synergetic effects, because people were allowed to pool their basic income. And because families, individuals, were embedded in kin networks, you could give people a very modest basic income, $50 a month, I think, which is a lot of money in the context of Namibia, but was nothing from the Ford Foundation's point of view. But they could pool it into to actual capital, which then the collective could use to buy means of production. You know, so it was, the amount was very small. It also meant that people could, for example, they had resources to be able to take the bus to the nearest town. So it had huge health effects, because it meant that people could go to the nearest town for health reasons. It had big nutrition effects, and one of the problems with productivity in very poor countries is the low productivity that comes from malnutrition. Not starvation, but just, you know, the energy levels that come from low nutrition. So this very modest unconditional basic income had huge effects on the village in the time, at least last I looked at the research reports from it. So in those contexts, it actually increased productivity. So if you're going from extreme poverty and bringing people up to a very modest, but from the cultural context, acceptable minimal standard of living, and allow them to pool resources, then it can have big productivity enhancing.
That's in a context that where some people may not always have access to employment without that. You know, if they're
right.
able to purchase their means of production, they're creating opportunity, whereas
right.
in America, that may not always be the case. Like, for example, if I'm poor and I receive UBI, even though it's redistributive, I might be able to say, well, you know, I'm really tired of working at McDonald's for minimum wage and you pushing me to, you know, do this and do that. So, you know, I'm checking out, or I can slack off
right.
at work.
Right. It's very hard to know what the dynamic effects would be of basic income. The Shmoo story version of it has a very thin cultural context. The dog patch residents are basically stereotyped as lazy and have no ambitions whatsoever in life, so that the UBI simply feeds into a culture of disengagement and sitting around smoking your corncob pipe. If you think about what would an unconditional basic income do, or a shmoo do, in a urban, you know, developed context like the United States, it's really hard to know. It would, I think, almost certainly affect the bargaining power between capital and labor, because it provides an unlimited strike fund for workers. You know, what the UBI does is, even if it's at basic subsistence level, it makes it possible for people to collectively withdraw labor. It's not so obvious to me that its effect would be under whatever new equilibrium bargaining conditions that creates, that it would mean workers wouldn't work hard under the new equilibrium. Because if the new equilibrium was in fact a class compromise where the collective power of labor was negotiating with capital under conditions where their bargaining power was high, they would still have a stake in the success of the firms under which they worked. They would want those firms to be profitable, because that's part of the conditions for their future, the future well-being of workers. This is an issue we'll be getting at a lot when we talk about class formation in a couple of weeks, the nature of class compromise. And although the terms of the bargain would be more favorable to labor, it's not clear that under those terms of the bargain, part of the bargain would be, and we're not going to work hard. Right? It's just that, the way I see UBI working with respect to labor and capital is shifting the power relations in a way that would create a more favorable equilibrium, but not a more favorable equilibrium that would have the character of a low-effort equilibrium. Because a low-effort equilibrium is not actually in the interests of workers, so long as they are going to be working in capitalism and have confidence in the longer-term class compromise of which they're a part. And so a basic income could just stabilize, I mean, this is just one possibility, it could stabilize the system at a more favorable balance of class power than exists. So it would make the United, it would, in a sense, be more like the class compromise of Sweden than the typical class compromise in the U.S. The other thing that basic income would do, I mean, this is a bit of a sideline from the current discussion of exploitation, but just to follow up on the question, I think a basic income would be an enormous subsidy to worker-owned co-ops. It would make worker-owned firms much more viable. In effect, you can think of a basic income as a redistribution of the social surplus from the capitalist to the cooperative sector. Because one of the big problems that worker co-ops have, particularly in their formative period when they're establishing themselves as an ongoing firm, is how do they provide food for their members, so to speak. They have to immediately start providing a stream of income on which people can live at the same time that they become a viable firm in a market economy. Right. They have these two tasks to accomplish. A capitalist firm doesn't have to do that as much because the capitalist firm comes with capital, with large savings. Worker-owned firms have to borrow the initial capital. So what typically happens for worker-owned firms is that they find it very hard to get credit from banks, not because banks are mean or banks are biased, prejudiced against worker firms, that they don't want to support worker firms because they see it as a threat to capitalism. No, it's because they see them as risky. And they're risky because they have to feed their members. I mean, using food as the metaphor for basic needs. So they'll demand from worker-owned firms more collateral or higher interest rates than they would from a comparable project by a capitalist firm. Because the worker firms don't have savings to draw on, the workers can't live off their savings, because they don't have large savings, during the several years it takes for a firm to become viable. If worker-owned firms had their basic income guaranteed, then they have a business plan, they go to a bank, they don't have to include some basic wages for their members in their business plan, right? That doesn't have to be part of the business plan. The viability of the firm does not depend upon them generating $15,000 a year, let's say, per person, per member, or whatever, you know, whatever the appropriate minimal basic subsistence level is. That suddenly makes all sorts of business plans more plausible than they would have been in the absence of a basic income. So basic income becomes a solution to a problem, a bottleneck in the credit market for worker-owned firms. Yeah?
Just one question. If basic income allows, and I guess there's a couple different effects it could have. It could allow people to just work less and maintain their same standard of living. If it allows poor people to consume more, wouldn't it just push prices up and they kind of be back in the same place where they were?
It's a complicated matter what the total dynamic effects of this would be. And I think it would take us way away from this current discussion. We will on the weekend when we discuss alternatives to capitalism and the envisioning whole, envisioning real utopia's idea of how to think about that. Part of that will focus specifically on basic income and the criticisms of it. So I think even though that means postponing it, that discussion for almost 2 months. I think it's better to do that than to get into it here. Yeah.
It seems to me that thinking about the Marxist implications of this, the possibility to look at actually existing shoes, as it were, we'd want to look at the oil-rich countries of the Middle East, which you know effectively have a shoe there, which is not dependent on exploitation of native labor to produce surplus value. So, you know, Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates, and those seem to be, you know, about as close as you could get to a costless shoe
right.
In the
right. So the Middle East, the Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. The Emirates are the kind of even stronger case than the. You know, they provide a lavish move for all citizens, combined with hyper exploitation of non-citizen labor, with then about 20% of the labor force being high-paid American and European professionals, who are not exploited, who are paid a lot for their services, kind of a premium for their services to be able to be there. So you have a non-exploited wage labor elite, a hyper-exploited non-elite wage labor, and a parasitic indigenous population. So it's a totally perverse kind of social structure. Yeah, I think, a lavish shmoo in a world where the shmoo is then exclusively controlled by a subgroup, creates a different kind of class structure than the shmoo in the story of Little Abner, or than the modest basic income that's usually being described. United Arab Emirate population that is living on the shmoo, a very significant part of them, really don't particularly work. They consume enormous amounts. If you don't have a job and you're a citizen of Abu Dhabi, one of the oil-rich parts of the Emirate, you automatically get a stipend of $50,000 a year, plus housing, plus free health care. That's your baseline, that's your shmoo. $50,000 a year income, plus health care, plus housing, without doing anything. And then if you work, you earn money above that. So, but we should move on. Okay. So all of this leads to this fundamental sociological insight, which is, now you've got it in the black box, which I also said at the end of the last lecture. Exploitation is a form of oppression that gives real power to the exploited, since they have levers of resistance and struggle absent from brute oppression. This makes exploitative relationships complex, explosive, and dynamic, and it's why around exploitation, whole systems of domination and containment are elaborated. So exploitation is the kind of social relation which provokes the creation of superstructures. So, think of it that way. If all you had is oppression, you could have a very, very thin superstructure. All you got to do is create barricades and keep the oppressed from causing trouble. Right? You just have to repress them. Simple, brute repression of those parts of the population that are marginalized, simple, brute repression is a pretty simple apparatus compared to the kind of apparatus needed when you have ongoing exploitation. And that's where I think the explanatory bite of exploitation comes from. Just a little note about the moral bite of exploitation. The ability of one group to exploit another depends upon the exploited group not having alternatives, right? Now the ability to exploit someone depends upon their vulnerability, about them not having viable exit options. This means that the exploiter would be opposed to the exploited becoming rich, even if this took the form of manna from heaven. That's what the shmoo story is all about. Now that is really, I think, by almost anybody's standards, a morally monstrous position to be in. It's bad enough to be indifferent to the welfare of the disadvantaged, but to have an actual stake in them remaining disadvantaged. That is, to have your interests threatened by their well-being. So you have this active interest in their ill-fare. That's building into social relations morally indefensible motivations. And it goes against, you know, any of the dominant world religions. You know, there's no religion which validates as a moral ideal creating social relations in which you have an active interest in perpetuating the harms of others. Most religions call in one form for another for compassion towards the disadvantages and the deprivations of others, where even if there's not a strong imperative to do something about it, you shouldn't be actively concerned about opposing doing something about it. Right? So that, and that's why, of course, rationalizations for the disadvantaged are part of superstructures. You know, people have to convince themselves that they're not actually in such a relationship. That the rich are rich not because the poor are poor, and furthermore, the rich are rich not because of the things that they have to do to keep the poor poor. You know, all of those things have to be ruled out from the perceptions of how the world works because it's so morally unacceptable. And I think that's a part of the hard wiring of our moral sensibilities. I don't think that's culturally specific. It's not a culturally specific moral code that says there's something monstrous about a group of people having a positive interest in perpetuating the ill-fare of others in this very strong sense that exploitation involves. In the notes it says a note about alienation, about the relationship between exploitation and alienation. I don't talk much about the concept of alienation in this course. It's another venerable Marxian idea, alienation as well as exploitation. Historically, biographically in Marx, in his early work he used the term alienation, in his later work he talks about exploitation. Exploitation and alienation are closely connected because they both have to do with in a sense, a person's relationship to their activities. You know, what happens to your activities and how are you related to your activities? Alienation is one way of describing your relationship. I am alienated from my own activities. Exploitation is another way of talking about your relationship to the activities. I think one way of thinking about this is that alienation and exploitation can be thought of as different effects of the same structure of relations. The social relations of production generate exploitation via the ways they structure the material interests of actors. So what we've been talking about is how the interests of different actors, the exploiter and the exploited, get structured by this peculiar set of relations. Those same relations generate alienation via the ways they shape the lived experience of people within production. So alienation is a way of describing the lived experience of actors under the same relations that generate exploitation as their connection of their interests to other people. Exploitation, then, I think, has a stronger relational aspect because it directly talks about the relationship between the interests of the people performing effort and the interests of people appropriating that effort. Whereas alienation describes the property of the lived experience of the people performing their effort. They feel that they don't control their effort isn't redounding to benefit their own lives in a flourishing way. That's the alienation relation. It's a relationship of you to your lived experience. But it doesn't so directly invoke the character of the lived experience of the exploiter. The exploiter is not unalienated. So it doesn't have the same kind of relational character. Marx almost, as far as I know, he doesn't talk about the extent to which capitalists are or are not alienated. they are never referred to as alienators, you know, that who produce the alienation of the alienated, in the way that they are exploiters, that whose activities are bound up with the activities of the exploited. And that's why I've been less drawn to it as a concept. It still comes in. It comes into our discussion. It'll come into our discussions of class consciousness. It's one aspect of the formation of subjectivity of actors within relations of exploitation. Their sense of disconnection from the fruits and the purposes of their own activities. That's part of the kind of lived experience of those relationships. And therefore, it can enter into certain kinds of explanations. But I don't think it has the same central relational character as the exploitation concept. Yeah?
Is there any reason to believe that it might be profitable for capitalists for labor to not be alienated?
Yeah, so there are lots of advanced social technologies of capitalist production which attempt to make workers feel more connected to their production, to their labor process, less alienated in that experiential sense from their immediate process of production, creating teams, for example, within production, creating quality circles. The vision of the Japanese Toyota plant in the heyday of Japanese capitalism, when that was seen as this model of advanced production. A lot of the discussion of that was precisely that it involved the more direct involvement of workers in their own conditions of production. It also involved workers having lifetime labor contracts. So arguably, the very social relations weren't the same. They had this very distinctive kind of employment relation, which really had this strong prospective character to it. Future-oriented character because of the lifetime labor contract. It didn't mean, of course, that Japanese workers weren't exploited. They were performing labor effort that was being appropriated by the owners of Toyota. And unlike in certain other systems, the Japanese shop floor worker did not typically have a capital stake in the firm. That is, these weren't firms in which the loyalty was being cemented by share ownership of workers. Now, share ownership of workers as a device for cementing loyalty taps into the exploitation dimension. It's to make workers at least feel less exploited because they get some dividends from the profitability of the firm, some redistribution of profits. Whereas this teamwork stuff is meant to make workers feel less dominated in production and therefore less alienated from their own labor. Yeah, so I think that's right. Yeah?
Where does Marx's concept of expropriation fit in here? Because I've heard the argument that he has alienation early in his career and the later equivalent is expropriation, but it seems that expropriation also has an element of exploitation to it, too.
Yeah, there's a number of different terms that get thrown about in these discussions. Expropriation, appropriation, exploitation. Right. So, you appropriate something. If you're appropriating the surplus, that is exploitation. That's just another way of saying expropriation. To say the workers are expropriated, I'm not exact, you'd have to see the sentence in which that was. So that could either be just another way of saying the surplus is appropriated. It could be a reference to the original dispossession of workers from the means of production. So there is this notion of what's called primitive accumulation. The vision, which is not historically very accurate, but the vision is you had workers who at one time owned the means of production. Those means of production are expropriated. They're taken away from the workers. And therefore, the workers have to sell their labor power to capitalists. That's not actually the way it typically happened, but yeah.
But I mean, isn't enclosure, and like the Enclosure Act in England and stuff, like isn't that exactly that?
Right, so but the way... The way it worked is the enclosures throw people off the land, they become destitute. And many of them become vagabonds, and they really become marginalized. It's not it is not typically the case that those are the same people who become laborers in capitalist factories. The actual process by which capitalist factories got built was you started with cottage industry, where weavers owned their looms and capitalists provided inputs to the looms. But the weavers, so the weavers had owned some of the means of production, but they didn't have capital in order to purchase on the regular market the inputs to production. And they didn't sell out of the open market the outputs of production. So weavers got their inputs from capitalist firms and contracted their outputs to the firms from whom they got the inputs. Right? So that's the putting out industry, cottage industry. The means of production, in the sense of the looms, were owned by the cottagers under those conditions. That went on for a fair length of time, variations on that theme, yeah.
But when the capitalist firms that were producing the thread that the cottage industry was using to make fabric, weren't those people who were running like the early water-powered machines and stuff like that, so they had to have hired labor too?
Yeah, right, but we're talking about when even the initial spinning of the threads was mixed. There was cottage industry for that as well. And that wasn't all done and centralized under one roof.
No, capitalist firms everywhere too.
Right. So, but here's the thing. What the historical story about how weavers became wage earners was not that capitalists took away their looms, you know, dispossessed them of those means of production, in the sense of took away their looms, and then they were penniless wage earners who had to go to work for the capitalists. That's not the actual process by which it occurred. The process by which it occurred was that the weavers were, the problem of social control over the labor of weavers was a constant problem for capitalists under the putting out system, because the surveillance was extremely weak. They didn't have foremen watching what the weavers did. It was very easy for the weavers to steal from the capitalists who were providing the inputs. So the capitalist provides the inputs. The weavers hive off 5 or 10% of the threads. They had all sorts of strategies for producing cotton, producing textiles to give back to the capitalists. That would that didn't have the thread count that they had contracted for, but it was very difficult to establish exactly what the rates would be. They were then producing textiles on their own, outside of the relationship by siphoning off parts of the thread. And in all sorts of other ways, making it very difficult to maintain the labor intensity that the capitalist firm wanted. The next step then was to insist that the weavers had to bring their looms to a central place. So they created factories in which the weavers still owned their own means of production. They had to bring them to the factory, but they were then under surveillance. So the initial creation of the factory was just for social control reasons. It wasn't because the factory provided higher productivity in a technological sense. It was exactly the same technology as the cottage industry, but organized in a different social structure, which made surveillance easier. But once the looms were all brought together under one roof, it then became possible to mechanize the looms. And then the weavers couldn't afford to buy their own looms. So the mechanization, the Industrial Revolution aspect, substituting power generated for the factory as a whole from the hand power, basically, of doing your own loom, you know, with pedals, that became economically feasible once the looms were brought under one roof. That enormously increased productivity, but at that point, the weavers no longer were capable of owning their own means of production, and they become full wage laborers. So it's a more complicated story of that transition, and it doesn't take the form of them being directly dispossessed of their means of production. What they were is vulnerable and unable to provide for the control over the entire commodity chain of production of cloth. Yeah.
I was just thinking that, at least generationally, those people who were somewhat dispossessed, because they never actually owned the land that was enclosed upon, they were just communally used. Like that generation, I was under the impression, were forced into the cities. There wasn't really much in the way of hiring power or anything to like actually like hire than the first couple generations. And those people were essentially like what England referred to as like the lost generation. They were all like alcoholics and stuff like that. But the next, once industrial production started taking off, they eventually became the people who were employed, at least those who didn't become artisans.
So it
funneled into that, at least, were like a positive feedback for productive power.
It's very tough to track the demographically the actual people. You know, the who were ex-peasants displaced from the land who became went to the city, who became artisans and then became industrial workers, as opposed to the children of urban residents who became artisans and became workers, as opposed to rural cottage industry who were artisanal productions in the countryside. So I don't know. I know there's huge debates in the early industrialization literature as to exactly demographically how you trace all of these developments. But our point at hand is just, of course, to get the conceptual clarity around exploitation and oppression here. Let me just wrap up this before we take the break with the issue of the extensions of this contrast of oppression and exploitation. So if we take the most abstract meaning of oppression and exploitation as being, oppression involves a thin form of interdependency of well-being. There's this negative interdependency of well-being that comes from exclusion of someone from of one group of people from access to something that's valuable to them. So you have a form of oppression where one group of people excludes another from access to something that's valuable to them. When we call it economic oppression, what they're being excluded from is some resource that enables them to generate a standard of living. But more generally, we can say a relationship is oppressive when one group is capable of excluding another group from access to something that's valuable to them. And exploitation is a description of that same relationship when, as a consequence of that exclusion, the exploiter is able to appropriate something from the excluded. Their lives become interdependent through an appropriation of some kind of effort. We can then talk about sexual oppression versus sexual exploitation, for example. In a heterosexist society, a heterosexist male-dominating society, one might say, for example, that homosexuality is a form of, the oppression of homosexuals is a form of sexual oppression, whereas women are sexually exploited by heterosexist men. So heterosexist men are sexually oppressive of homosexual men, of homosexuality, but exploitative of heterosexual women. So the reasoning here would be, and there's this sort of snap your fingers test. For heterosexist men, if they could snap their fingers and have homosexuality just disappear, they would do so. You know, because they have no active interest in the reproduction of homosexuality, it's just that they find it abhorrent in a way that they want to repress it. They want to exclude homosexuals from the public arena of legitimate expressions of sexual identities or sexual preferences. So snapping your fingers and have them disappear in the same way that if North American settlers came to North America, they could snap their fingers and have it be an unpopulated continent, that would be even better. So they don't have an active interest in the reproduction of the oppressed category. They just have an active interest in its repression. That's clearly not the case with respect to the sexuality of heterosexual women with respect to heterosexual men. They require, for the fulfillment of their own sexual desires, the sexual energy and activity and effort of women. But they want to do so on terms that are defined by male heterosexuality. Now that gives women a form of power in those relations that homosexual men do not have in their relationship to heterosexual men. Right, so you see the kind of parallel I mean, I don't want to push this parallel to the point of saying that, you know, in every respect we have to kind of see the exact analogy. But there is this, there is a similar logic. The expression, the battle of the sexes, right, that reflects the fact that the sexual compromise that occurs within heterosexist relations embodies a form of a capacity for resistance on the part of women, which gives them levers in those relations so that a bargains get struck in forms that would not be available if they were simply an oppressed category with respect to the social relations around which sexuality and sexual practices are taken out, are acted out. So I think we could distinguish sexual oppression from sexual exploitation, and the struggles around overcoming sexual oppression and the struggles around sexual exploitation would have connections but still distinct properties. One could also talk about perhaps cultural oppression versus exploitation. Now, this might be a little bit more slippery, but I think nevertheless one could draw the contrast between the treatment of Native American culture in the 19th and early 20th centuries compared to the treatment of indigenous cultures today. And we might describe the 19th century as an era of cultural oppression, where the goal was the obliteration of the indigenous culture, versus the treatment of indigenous cultures today, which is in which the central relation involves the appropriation of cultural products from indigenous cultures. So an example would be in the 19th century and into the 20th century in many settler colonies, settler regions of the world, United States, Australia, Canada would be good examples. Children in indigenous people were forced to go to schools, boarding schools, where they were prohibited from speaking their indigenous languages. And the idea was to eradicate the indigenous language by undermining the linguistic competence of children from an early age to speak the indigenous language. And that was the explicit goal, to civilize these indigenous people, to make them fully competent to be part of the larger community. The goal was to obliterate the culture. The benign aspect of the goal was to make it easier for these children to become part of the mainstream of the society. The idea was not that they would go back to the reservations and live their life in isolation from the rest of American society. The well-meaning, in quotes, people who were pushing for this thought that the result of this would be assimilation. You know, that was the term of art used for this. But I think one could describe this as cultural oppression. And indeed, in the indigenous movements, it's even been called cultural genocide, which I think is an apt expression. And as with economic oppression, the genocidal destroy only good Indian is a dead Indian aspect makes some sense. If you have no value in that indigenous culture and there's nothing you're going to get from it, then the best way to deal with the cultural conflicts that are bound up with it is to obliterate it. And assimilation is the positive face of obliteration. You know, I mean, which I think should be recognized. That's why it's contradictory. It has this positive face to it. Compare that to the contemporary period where there's a kind of veneration of certain symbolic aspects of indigenous culture. New Age spirituality is deeply connected to symbols from Native Americans in various ways. And there's a continual appropriation of the cultural products of the indigenous people, but an appropriation for purposes of benefiting the advantaged culture, not for purposes of validating and resourcing the indigenous culture, but for purposes of a transfer and an absorption. The New Age version of Native American spirituality, of course, is a highly distorted version. That doesn't make it a bad thing in and of itself. I mean, cultures distort each other all the time. That's how cultures evolve, is by appropriation and whatever. But it is a very different relationship to the indigenous culture than existed under conditions of cultural oppression. And as in the economic case, when one can say the one thing worse than being exploited is not being exploited, that is, a pure economic oppression is worse than economic exploitation, I think that's also true around culture. It's better to be culturally exploited than to be culturally oppressed. It gives you more room to maneuver. It makes it possible to create barriers to the destruction of cultural forms and to have forms of resistance that actually reproduce it under conditions in which there is some appropriation taking place. You know, so cultural exploitation is not to be condemned in the same way that cultural oppression is. And the struggle then is towards mutual recognition and full respect rather than this asymmetrical appropriation relationship that occurs, which of course is intensified by the connection between that cultural appropriation and capitalist exploitation, because cultural products become commodities as well and enter into the capitalist arena. Okay, that's the end of the exploitation discussion. The next topic, which is another very meaty topic, you know, it's another one of the kind of big, gutsy core issues, is how to think about complexities of class structure. Given that we want a concept of class that then incorporates these ideas of exploitation, that's the distinctiveness of this whole domain of class concepts, then we have to deal with this problem of how do we deal with complexity as opposed to just simple polarized class relations. And that's a kind of big, interesting topic. That's the topic that I was preoccupied with for 20 years. We're at 10 after 11 now. We certainly, there's no way in the world we're going to get through all this in the next half hour, but I think we should just kind of chug along and see. At some point, at the rate we're going on this, at some point we probably will have to cut out either, sort of cut out half a lecture, and the question is which topic can be shortchanged with the least aggravation to either you or me. But let's take our break now. I'll turn this off. And then, so the all right. Any other questions, issues from the exploitation part before we move on? Let me pass around the complexities of class structure. Here, I'll send them around on two waves. Any other thoughts? Okay, complexity. Let me make a couple of comments about complexity. So these are of the, first some comments of the very general character that apply to all sorts of areas. It's a common criticism of a particular theoretical formulation that the world is more complex than that, right? So as you wend your way through sociology and theoretical discussions on different problems, a really common objection to some argument that somebody will make is, it's too simple. The world is more complex than that. So my first point is that's really a cheap shot. It's never an adequate criticism of a theory that the world is more complicated than the theory. If the theory didn't in some way or other simplify the complexity of the world, it wouldn't be a good theory. It would just be a description of the complexity. What we want is our theories to be simplifications. Now, the claim that it's an oversimplification is potentially a valid claim, but oversimplification is never shown by simply pointing out that the world is more complex. That's never an adequate way of showing that a theory is oversimplified. Oversimplification means that for the explanatory tasks it has, it misses something fundamental. Oversimplification is often really a criticism that it's simplified in the wrong ways. Not that it's oversimplified, but it's badly simplified. It is simply simplified in the wrong ways. So, for example, take rational choice theory. Rational choice theory. It's a radical simplification of the human agent. It regards human agents as rational choosers that are trying to maximize across a set of alternatives. Now, we know that people aren't like that. So it's a cheap shot to say that theory is wrong. It's unsatisfactory. We should get rid of it because people are more complicated than that. What you have to show is that for the things that rational choice theory tries to explain, the things that are missing are actually the things that are explanatory. So it requires the juxtaposition of an alternative that shows that it's wrong. So a person who believes that people really follow scripts, that the core explanation for why people behave the way they do is that they've internalized a set of scripts which they simply follow out of habit. That we are homo habilis, not homo sapiens. We're people of habit. And that virtually everything we do is just rote, script following. And that it's just that some of the scripts also mimic what we would do if we were acting rationally. But that there's nothing particularly rational about it. It doesn't capture anything about the process by which the behaviors are executed. Well, that's a juxtaposition of two simplifications. Because a script follower need not say there are no circumstances in which you make some marginal choices. There's no thinking that ever goes on in action. But that the actions are just super, super circumscribed by the scripts which you have to follow. And if that's where all the action is with respect to the things you're trying to explain. So that's my first point about complexity. You worry about complexity because the lack of complexity is causing you difficulties to explain the things you want to explain. Not simply because of some fetish for complexity. In fact, if you want to choose your fetish in social science, I think it's always better to be oversimplified than overcomplexified. I think it's a bigger problem in social science and sociology that there's too much stuff thrown into the pot and that you really lose sight of the forest for the trees and you can't track what the actual argument is because there's too much going on. I would rather have a clear, oversimplified analysis that's really interesting and provocative, and which could be wrong because of its willingness to commit to a set of explanations, than the kind of explanation which hedges every possible bet by adding every possible complication so that you never know really where the ground lies. Okay, that's a meta comment about complexity. Now, in the particular context we're operating, we face the following kind of issue. The abstract concept of class relations, which I've been laying out, and particularly around the concept of exploitation, generates a simple polarized idea of the relations of class relations. There are capitalists and workers in capitalism. In the Schmooze story, there are really only two kinds of actors. Now, there's a little bit of complexity because PU has a manager. But in the story, the PU and the manager are really a very solid coalition. The manager is the direct collaborator with the capitalist and is clearly not an autonomous, is not an actor with autonomous interests. There's no tacit story about the separation of ownership and control, so to speak, between the owner and the manager in that story. So there's really only two classes in the Schmooze story. The world certainly seems more complex than that, and for lots of things we want to explain, there's a lot of the things we want to use class to help us understand, you know, that complexity seems to matter. If you want to explain voting behavior, if you want to explain the patterns of economic development in the United States and the nature of the conflicts that occur in cities over time and how it's changed, if you want to understand the class and race and their interconnection, you know, all of these things. It seems that to really understand the mechanisms involved, simply knowing that there are exploiters and exploited, capitalists and workers, is not adequate. That's not a sufficient concept for the task. There are two broad strategies. I think I've invoked this point earlier. There are two broad strategies you could take given that. Okay, we've got a polarized class concept. It's compelling. It's got good theoretical arguments behind it. We've now worked on the concept of exploitation to give it more sociological meat, to make it less dependent upon a particular formulation, the labor theory of value formulation. So there's two ways we could go from that polarized concept to more complex analysis. One is we can say we need to add a lot of other explanatory principles besides class. So in addition to class, for example, we may want to introduce a concept of strata. So we may want to say, yes, we've got this basic class relation, but then in terms of how you explain actual behavior, people's own behavior and strategies are shaped not just by their class position, but by their position within a system of stratification, which is a different principle of inequality. So we have two things operating, stratification logic, more or less income, more or less housing, you know, wealth. So we have stratification measures of various sorts, and that affects people's behavior, and we have a polarized class. If you put those things together, what you then get is, within the working class defined as all people who are exploited by capital, which is a very large part of the population, 80%, let's say, within the working class, there are strata. But that isn't changing the class concept. It's saying we have a non-class, a non-relational class idea, which is simply standard of living, which also affects behavior. So one way of adding complexity is to add all sorts of additional causal processes. Strata, education, gender, race, ethnicity, region of the country, historical traditions, culture. You know, you could add a huge menu of things to explain why people vote the way they do, and say class really doesn't do much for you there. Class isn't giving you much of the explanatory force. So the burden on class analysis is then relieved. It says class doesn't explain directly voting behavior. You then can propose a more complicated theory, which is class explains how these stratification variables work. So it's not that class predicts voting. Class predicts how education predicts voting. Class explains how race predicts voting. Class explains how gender. So it's an interaction model, basically. The causal connection between these all these other things and voting is itself explained by class. That's a more complicated theory, but you've kept the class concept super simple. Still just polarized. Are you a capitalist? Are you a worker? Or are you some residual other? You know, you might have a third category. That's one way to go. An alternative way to go is to say the concept of class itself can be rendered more complex. That the simple polarized idea that we've used to get its foundations actually, when you apply it to concrete cases, the actual world isn't polarized in that way. And you have to think about a variety of complexities when you translate that very abstract concept to more concrete contexts. There are broadly two kinds of complexities, and I've pursued that route. Now, I should say, that's a theoretical decision, right? So when I started out doing this, I wasn't as reflexive about it as I am now. One of the consequences of having worked for 2 decades in a very concentrated way on this problem, sort of from the early 70s until the early 90s, you know, sort of a 20-year period, and then in a less concentrated way, I still keep coming back to it over the last 15 years or so. So one of the consequences of working on it for so long is that you become more and more reflexive after the fact about the moves you made early on, which were only partially thought out. So I clearly made the choice right on, I am going to try to solve this problem by working on the concept of class and rendering it more complex, rather than by keeping it as simple as possible and adding other complexities. So the main thrust of my work has been how to complexify. I don't know if that's a real word or not. It seems better than how to complicate. how to complexify the concept of class. That's the strategy I adopted. I don't have a hard argument in favor of that strategy. I think in the end, my only defense of that strategy is pragmatic. If keeping a simple concept of class and producing a more complex set of interactions with other concepts would actually illuminate problems more deeply, that is, after you do it, you think, aha, now I have new insights that I didn't have before. If that does it more effectively, then by adding more complexity, building it into the concept itself, well, then that would have been a better route to take, perhaps. There is a cost to my strategy. It tends to make the concept of class have less bite to it. You know, as you move to this more complex level, the concept loses this sharp moral edge of the polarized class relations. But it does a lot more work for you in empirical study. So there's trade-offs. I don't mean by saying that it's a pragmatic decision that I take then a non-realist view of science, where I don't think there are real mechanisms out there that we're trying to discover. What I'm saying is that our mental exercises in concept formation and theory construction that aid us in making those discoveries always have arbitrary elements to them that are purely the result of how we are playing the intellectual game of building our concepts and whatever, and that there is no hard definitive way of deciding which of those actually is better, other than by seeing how they work in practice when you play them out. And this is very unstable in social science. It tends to be more stable in the natural sciences. This is very unstable in social sciences because the relationship between whatever our conceptual frameworks and theories are and the evidence that we gather, that relationship is itself a more precarious one. There's more distance between our concepts and our observations, no matter how you cut the pie here. Cut the pie is probably not the right metaphor. No matter what recipe you use, it's always more problematic, which makes any solution that you have less definitive. Well, I've added complexity in two main ways. One is to add complexity in the nature of the locations themselves that people occupy. So to go from polarized relations and locations within polarized relations, I have added a variety of different types of complexity in defining what is actually the locations. The general term I've used to capture that aspect of the problem is contradictory locations within class relations. That term is a way of describing a complexity in the nature of the locations themselves. Managers, for example, can be thought of as occupying the capitalist location in the ways they dominate labor, but the working class location in the ways they are dominated by capital, and in many cases also exploited by capital. So managers are simultaneously, in this view, in the capitalist class and the working class, simultaneously in two class locations, because the relations that define the specificity of their position are disaggregated. They are dominators and dominated, exploiters and exploited within the same relations. And that is a particular kind of complexity in the location itself. Another kind of locational complexity that I've introduced concerns the temporal character of class positions. The temporal character. So some jobs that people occupy have career structures which move them over time into more and more dominating positions. Now you can think of that in two different ways. You can either say that they have, that the person moves from one position to another, or you can say the position actually has a temporal structure to it. So it, the clearest case of all is, I think, is Toyota, where every manager in Toyota, in the heyday of the Toyota system, spent a year or two on the shop floor doing the ordinary work of ordinary production line workers. That was part of what it meant to be a manager, is that you spent a couple of years doing ordinary production work, being bossed around in the same way as every other worker. You had to learn what it was like to be on the shop floor before you were allowed to be a manager. Now, it's a misdescription of that to say that there is mobility between working class positions and managerial positions, I think. I think it's better to think of the managerial position itself as having a temporal structure that begins as a worker. Yeah?
All right, so okay, I was a little bit confused when I was reading about this, because I didn't know if you're also referring to situations in which people are hired as like production workers, but then later become managers, and it seems like to me that that would be a case of mobility.
So the devil is in the details here. So if you have as a regular part of the career structure of the job that all managers are recruited from workers, but the recruitment process has the character of a lottery, or a lottery that's tempered by performance. It'll always be some by lottery, I just mean there's a randomness to it. But it may be a lottery tempered by performance. Then I would say the class position has two properties to it. One is it has a temporal structure, but it also has an indeterminate character. And indeterminate is different from ambiguous. It means that the temporality of that particular kind of position has indeterminacy in it. And that's a property of the position itself, if it's a stable structure. That is, if this is a stable structure in which the rules of the game are such that every worker knows that there's a 10% chance they'll become a manager, and they know that the rules of the game for becoming a manager are some combination of luck and working hard, and that becomes then a property of their job as a worker. That is, their job has a future, a prospective character to it that has a stochastic element. It's partially random and partially determinate. And that's a different kind of working class position than one in which there's a sharp line of division between workers and managers and no promotions between them. And it's also different from the Toyota system, in which for most workers there's zero probability of being, and workers know it. For most employees, there's a zero probability of becoming a proper manager. The most is they might become a foreman late in their career. But for roughly 5% of the workers at any given time, they know that unless they screw up and are totally, you know, incompetent, they will become managers, because they're just doing a first stage of the managerial career.
So am I correct in thinking that saying, like, going back to your example with Toyota, that even production line workers who don't necessarily have a promise that they're going to move up are still considered in this managerial class?
No. The managerial, in the Toyota case, that's why it's a kind of clean one. People are hired as managers and said for the next 2 years you're going to be on the shop floor.
Okay, let's assume that they aren't. Let's assume that, like, people are workers and then they have the opportunity to work their way up. But it's, you know, the probability of them doing that is based on luck and good work. So you're saying that even people who are like production line workers are in the same class position as the managers?
No. Well, all of this means that there's more ambiguities in it. So when you add this indeterminacy and randomness, it means that the interests of actors become less clear-cut.
I see.
See, the point is, the reason we care about class location is because it helps us understand the interests of actors and their strategies which they're likely to have. So in universities, a good example is graduate students are proto-professors, assistant professors are on tenure track, lecturers are in ambiguous positions because they're not on tenure track. There's all these issues. The strategies of assistant professors would be very different if they knew there was zero chance of tenure, that is, getting permanent job rights, than knowing that they have a high chance if they produce well. It just changes the way you relate to the job, the institution, And in a way that just doesn't reflect false consciousness. It reflects the real material conditions of the social relations under which you're doing your work. This is all about the temporal character. This is adding complexity to the nature of the positions. So that's one family of complexities. Complexities that the positions are not as simple as we thought, and in ways that matter for what we're trying to explain. Propensity to join a union, propensity to go on strike, willingness to vote for certain kinds of parties or others, etc. The other kind of complexity has to do with how people's lives get connected to class structures. Now, sometimes that's not so clearly different from the first. This worker-manager promotion thing, that there's some ambiguity. You know, once it's not clearly inscribed as a career structure that's very well built, and there's becomes more and more randomness in it, it's less and less clear that we're talking about how an individual life moves through a class structure versus how a position itself has a temporal structure. So, you know, it becomes less clear. When we use the term career, we're meaning to define the temporal structure of positions. When we talk about mobility, we're talking mostly about how people move through positions. But there's lots of ways in which there's complexities in how individual lives get connected to class structures. One is through families. That, I think, is the biggest one, the one that has the biggest bite. We'll talk about that later. I call those mediated class relations. If you're in a family and you're a child in the family, your relationship to the class structure is mediated by your relationship to your parents. So it's reasonable to call the child of a wealthy capitalist as a child, as a capitalist class kid, rather than a child that has no class because of their privileged access to capital by virtue of kinship relations. And it's reasonable to say that a working class child is in the working class, but not by virtue of their position in the class structure. They don't have a position in the class structure. But it's also misleading to just say they don't have a position in the class structure. That also doesn't capture the nature of their location. So these two kinds of complexities, complexities in how lives are linked to locations and complexities in the character of locations. What we'll do in the next lecture, which I guess means that we're now officially close to a lecture behind, so be it, is we will systematically go through these various strategies I've used in these kinds of complexities. Okay. Thank you.